From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Last night, in his first speech as president-elect, George W. Bush emphasized the importance of unity. But he's facing a very divided legislature. On today's Fresh Air, we take a look at the new Congress with New York Times congressional correspondent Eric Schmidt. Bush also referred to another close election, the presidential race of 1800, which was tied in the Electoral College, then tied in the House of Representatives. After 6 days and 36 ballots, Thomas Jefferson emerged the winner. It's an election that could have led to violence and ended the democracy, but it didn't. We'll talk with Bernard Weisberger, author of a book about that election. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. George W. Bush settled into the business of being president-elect today. He began the day at a special prayer service with members of his campaign staff. Later, he received calls and telegrams of congratulations from foreign leaders such as British Prime Minister Tony Blair and Mexico's newly elected President Vicente Fox. Bush also made plans to go to Washington next week for talks with congressional leaders President Clinton and Vice President Gore. The incoming GOP administration is scrambling to make up for time lost during the election dispute. Today, Vice President-elect Dick Cheney received the keys for the federally funded Presidential Transition Office in Washington, D.C. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
Cheney received the keys at the makeshift Bush Transition Headquarters in McLean, Virginia. The Bush campaign set up shop there shortly after Election Day when federal officials refused to give them $5 million and access to the official offices set aside for the president-elect. But with Vice President Al Gore's concession last night, officials said it was finally time to turn over the key. Well, not exactly a key. It was more like a computerized smart card. Cheney says the transition team will use both offices for the time being. He also said President-elect Bush plans to visit Washington early next week to meet with President Clinton, Vice President Gore, and members of Congress. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
Florida Governor Jeb Bush has named a task force to look into his state's election problems and recommend solutions. Bush said the panel would address concerns about the integrity of Florida's election process. He noted that there have been allegations that felons voted and some voters' names were improperly removed from the rolls. The panel includes 10 Republicans, 10 Democrats, and one person with no party affiliation. Law enforcement officials are launching the largest ever drive to get drug and alcohol-impaired drivers off the nation's highways. This weekend, they're setting up hundreds of sobriety checkpoints in all 50 states. NPR's Ebong Udama reports.
The law enforcement agencies are being joined by anti-drunk driving advocacy groups who say they'd like to see the adoption of a 0.8 blood alcohol level standard for DUI arrest in all 50 states. National Commission Against Drunk Driving spokesman Harold Watson says only 19 states have so far adopted the standard.
We've sent a letter to the governors of those states who don't have 0.08, encouraging them to support that legislation, encouraging them to do the right things, because it's proven that 0.08 saves lives.
Watson says last year, 16,000 people were killed and more than 300,000 injured in car crashes. Ebong Udama, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 119 points, or just over 1%, to close at 10,675. This is NPR. President Clinton is on his way home from an effort to revive the peace process in Northern Ireland. The three-day visit included stops in Northern Ireland, Britain, and Ireland. He met with leaders of the various parties in Belfast, encouraging them to work out a dispute over when and how the Irish Republican Army will get rid of its weapons. AOL has preliminary approval to merge with Time Warner. A key federal agency signed off on the deal today, leaving just one more approval to go. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The Federal Trade Commission has given its blessing to the AOL merger, but that approval came with lots of conditions. AOL Time Warner will have to open its cable TV network to internet service providers other than AOL. The company has also promised it will not give up on providing internet access over telephone lines, which is the main competitor to cable internet access. Richard Parker, the FTC's antitrust chief, said without these conditions, the agency would have tried to stop the merger in court.
I believe this was an illegal merger, which is remedied by this order.
Now the Federal Communications Commission must give its approval. Some groups want the FCC to require more access to AOL's instant messaging service, which is now closed to competitors. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Prices at the wholesale level edged up by only 0.1% in November. The Labor Department said lower prices for heating oil and prescription drugs helped offset higher prices for natural gas and fresh vegetables. Prices stayed about the same for items other than food and energy, which can vary a lot from month to month. It was the best inflation performance in the past 3 months. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The location for George W. Bush's first address as president-elect was the chamber of the democratically controlled Texas House of Representatives. Bush said he chose that location because it's the home of bipartisan cooperation. He said the spirit of what he's seen in that hall is what is needed in Washington. Good luck. The U.S. Congress is one of the most divided of the past 100 years. The Senate is split 50-50. The House has 221 Republicans, 211 Democrats, 2 independents, and 1 seat left vacant by the death of Democrat Julian Dixon. That seat is likely to be filled by another Democrat. The new faces in Congress include Hillary Clinton, who will be working with the Republicans who led the impeachment of her husband. This morning I spoke with Eric Schmidt, a congressional correspondent for the New York Times. I asked him to compare the president-elect's legislative agenda with the agenda of the hardline Republican leadership of Congress, House Majority Leader Dick Armey, House Majority Whip Tom DeLay, and Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott.
In many ways, the agendas are the same. Of course, the governor, and he mentioned this again last night in his speech about talking about compassionate conservatism. He talks about education, and one of the first things he'll want to do is legislation improving the ability of children, school children, to read. He's talked about a major tax cut, $1.3 billion tax cut over 10 years. And he's also talked about Social Security and working across party lines to reform the Social Security system as well as the Medicare system. Where you have differences, however, with some of the more hardline Republicans in Congress are their priorities in looking at privatizing Social Security, for instance. In implementing a program of school vouchers, of carrying out legislation banning partial birth abortion. These are all things that the governor in one form or another has supported, but I think in a Congress that is this evenly divided are not going to be things that he is going to want to put forward first. The governor is going to be on the spot to try and get some legislation through on a bipartisan basis very quickly. This will be very important for him to try and gain some traction coming off this very bitterly contested election. And he's going to need some accomplishments. He's not coming in with any kind of broad popular mandate. And so what he's going to have to do is very quickly take on some perhaps rather more bite-sized type pieces of legislation, things that perhaps have already passed the Congress but were vetoed by President Clinton, and then move forward on those.
Well, the Republican leadership in Congress is more hardline than President-elect Bush may be. What is his relationship to Armey, DeLay, and Lott?
Well, it's interesting. I think he has a fairly good relationship overall with the Republicans on the Hill, although he did keep them at somewhat of an arm's length during the campaign. One aspect to watch is President Bush, President-elect Bush's relationship with Tom DeLay, who's really the conservative leader of Republicans, certainly in the House and perhaps of the entire Congress. These two guys have had a strained relationship in the past. Governor Bush raised some questions about the way the congressional Republicans were pushing ahead with programs that hurt the poor, and DeLay kind of snapped back at him when he did that. So I think there was a little bit of mistrust built up between DeLay and Governor Bush's father during the first Bush presidency. So I think this is going to be a fascinating dynamic to watch, is to see which which Republicanism really comes through. Is it the compassionate conservatism that George Bush espouses, or is it the more hard-edged, more partisan, ideological, perhaps, programs that Tom DeLay and some of the more conservatives in Congress would like?
Now, you can talk about uniting, but the Republican leaders of Congress are the people who led the impeachment of President Clinton. And the Bush team blocked the Florida recount every step of the way. Tom DeLay sent a memo to congressional Republicans pointing out that Congress can reject a state's electoral votes if they felt the votes were tainted. This would have been a way of overturning the election if Gore ended up winning the Florida recount. Do you think that the Republican leadership really wants to forge a spirit of bipartisanship and unity and compromise?
Well, they've certainly been talking the talk. Trent Lott, for instance, the Senate Majority Leader, yesterday was asked several times about this after some lunches that they had with Dick Cheney when they came up, and he stressed the fact that while there have been very bitter partisan differences in the past, and he's disagreed with both the tactics and the programs of Democrats, he's hoping for a fresh start. He's obviously in an extraordinarily difficult position, being the majority leader of a Senate that's evenly divided for the first time since the late 1800s, and he'll be looking for a lot of help from the Bush administration to take some of that burden off of him. Dick Cheney, of course, as vice president, will serve as a tie-breaking vote. But I think more than just that role, that visible role as a tiebreaker, Cheney will be on the Hill a lot more than any other vice president, perhaps helping Republicans on the House and Senate side, working out strategy, working out tactics, because he realizes, as does Governor Bush, that they need to have some accomplishments. They need to get something done and get something done quickly to try and both unify the country, but also establish a certain amount of legitimacy for a presidency that has a huge cloud hanging over it right now.
What about the Democratic leadership? Do you think the Democrats in Congress are very angry and bitter, both about the impeachment and the aftermath of that, and how the election aftermath was handled?
I think to some extent, you know, impeachment is there, but it's under the surface, and it's kind of fading even as President Clinton exits the scene. Obviously, the election is a much more visceral frustration and disappointment that many Democrats are feeling. I think particularly among black members of Congress, I think you'll see them in talking about how black voters in Florida were disenfranchised. This is going to linger a long time with them, and I think it's going to be interesting to watch how the Congressional Black Caucus deals with this. In terms of the leadership, both Dick Gephardt and Tom Daschle, I think Gephardt realizes, as well as Daschle, that that they, particularly Daschle with a 50-50 Senate, they can be tarred with the same brush of this question of partisanship. But Daschle emerges as perhaps one of the most powerful people in Washington now, as head of the Senate Democrats, and the ability to lead the all-powerful filibuster in the Senate, where you need 60 votes, a supermajority, to break off any debate in the Senate. So I think both Gephardt and Daschle had supported Vice President Gore in his efforts up to this point, even though relations between them haven't always been the best. But I think they've quickly also rallied around this question of trying to unify and the Congress and the country around here. I think though they're waiting to see some concrete steps both from Governor Bush, now President-elect Bush, as well as from the Republicans in Congress, who they've come to distrust so much. There's just you can't underestimate the amount of distrust that exists right now, perhaps, you know, because in large part because of impeachment, but certainly over this last very difficult election cycle. And with many people, many Democrats and Republicans already looking to the 2002 congressional elections.
Now, since the Senate is 50-50, if there is a tie vote, it's the vice president who breaks that vote. For 17 days in January, the vice president is going to be Al Gore because the people in Congress get sworn in, new congressional members get sworn in 17 days before the new president gets sworn in. Is there any talk in Congress now of Democrats taking advantage of those 17 days in which Al Gore could be the tiebreaker in the Senate?
Certainly there's been talk along those lines. Senator Daschle has told me that he does not expect to take advantage of that time when he'll technically be the Senate Majority Leader. But he does have certain leverage there in his discussions with Senator Lott about organizing the committees in the Senate. Right now, the Senate Democrats would like to have parity on the Senate committees, basically a 50-50 split on membership, although they're more likely to recognize a Republican chairman. Many Republicans have rejected this, saying that they're the ones technically, well, not just technically, but they are the ones in the majority with Vice President Cheney's tie-breaking vote. They should be the ones with one extra seat on the committees to be able to have a clear mandate to set the agenda. There have been some Republican senators, some committee chairmen, such as Jesse Helms, John McCain, who said they wouldn't have a problem with parity on the committees. But this rubs a lot of Republicans the wrong way, and so this is something they're still trying to work out.
How are these things decided? Like which party should get the majority when things are ambiguous as they are now?
Well, this is all the Senate. The Senate makes its own rules, and in that way, it's kind of a unique institution in the American government. And so when Lott and Daschle sit down to discuss this, they really don't have a lot of precedent to look back over to guide them. I think, obviously, practical politics work into it. The priorities of their own respective conferences play into it. But this is something that Lott and Daschle have been talking about. They'll continue to talk about. They'll have to take back to their members and see what can be acceptable. I think Lott is under a lot of pressure from his members not to give in to Democrats, particularly on the key committees such as banking, finance, and appropriations that deal with the money appropriations and all. But I think the Democrats have to be careful in what they ask for here and what they wish, and that if they do get parity, the Republicans are going to be in a position to assign not only equal responsibility but equal blame to anything that goes wrong, unlike what's been going on for the last few years with Republican control, where Democrats have been able to basically run against a Republican Congress, labeling them a do-nothing Congress. Republicans, of course, accuse Democrats of obstructionism and of deliberately not doing much, to use that in election campaign fodder. But so Democrats have to be a little bit careful about what they ask for here. If they get if they do get true parity on these committees, they could be held equally responsible if things go bad and again the atmosphere up on Capitol Hill goes quite partisan again.
There's been talk that there's a couple of people in Congress who might end up leaving before their term is up. Strom Thurmond is 98. Which is pretty old by anybody's standard. Jesse Helms is 78, but he's had a lot of health problems, including cancer, heart bypass, and a nerve disorder. If either of them left the Senate, how would their replacement be chosen, and how might that affect the balance of power?
Well, this is one of the hottest topic of kind of rumors and actuarial guessing that's going on in Washington right now. It's just kind of the death watch, as morbid as it sounds, over Strom Thurmond and Jesse Helms and perhaps other senators. There are seven senators now in the Senate who are over the age of 75. Right now, Thurmond and Helms, for instance, come from states with Democratic governors, and so their successors would be picked by, at least their interim successors would be picked by Democratic governors, would presumably be Democrats, and would then swing the margin of control to the Democrats. Last week, there were wild rumors that Jesse Helms, for instance, had pancreatic cancer and other such illnesses, and was on death's bed in North Carolina. Well, this got to the point where the senator's press secretary Mark Thiessen put out actually a very funny press release denying all these rumors and basically telling the press to basically get used to it. Senator Helms was here whether they liked it or not, and ready to torment them for more years. And so and I actually talked to Senator Helms about this himself, and he looked to me, at least, to be in the best shape he's been in several months. I think he's been getting some extra rest down in North Carolina.
My guest is Eric Schmidt, congressional correspondent for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Eric Schmidt is my guest. He's a congressional correspondent for The New York Times. He's been covering Congress for 5 years. One thing that President-elect Bush could try is to offer a cabinet post to a Democratic member of the Senate who is from a state with a Republican governor, in the hopes that if the Democratic senator moves out into a cabinet position, they would be replaced by a Republican senator, thus breaking the tie. Any talk about that?
There has been some talk about that, but again, given the very narrow margins in the Senate, 50-50, I think right now it'd be very unlikely that a Democrat from a state with a Republican governor or a Republican for a Democratic governor would voluntarily give up his seat at this point and effectively hand control of the Senate to the opposite party. I think that would be political suicide for that member. What you might see are certain senators whose names are floated use that speculation to their advantage as leverage within their own party and perhaps even with the opposite party to get some of the legislative goodies that they're looking for, and use that as kind of a threat, if you, not a threat so much as but just as leverage over everyone to get more of what they want.
You know, we've been talking about some of the divisions in Congress. There is a centrist coalition in the Senate. How important do you think the centrist coalition will be, and how effectively does it function?
Well, it's interesting because they had their first meeting the other day, and it's a group headed by John Breaux of Louisiana and Olympia Snowe of Maine, who are Democrat and Republican, and they got 26 members of the Senate, you know, more than a quarter of the Senate to show up. I think that shows you something right there, that it's kind of chic to be centrist here, and that people are picking up on the idea that if anything's going to work in the Congress or in the administration, it's going to be governing from the center. Obviously, that's been Governor Bush's message. It's been a message that now both Democrats and Republicans are picking up and echoing on the Hill. And so you have this, the seeds here of, you know, the possibility of some bipartisan cooperation in the sense of this centrist group being able to be the swing votes that carry legislation on the key things that we've been talking about, in education and health care and taxes. And you have people like John McCain coming over to join this group. John Warner, who's not normally associated with the centrist, joining up. John Warner, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee. So it's going to be a fascinating dynamic to kind of watch this unfold. In the past, the centrists and the moderates, and particularly in the House, have talked a good game, but they really haven't been able to exert the kind of influence over legislation that I think they had hoped for, with a few possible exceptions, such as the minimum wage fight. But now, with this bitterly contested election and the aftermath of this, I think there will be at least an opportunity, a window, if you will, for these centrists to kind of hold sway.
I believe you covered Dick Cheney when he was Secretary of Defense in the previous George Bush administration, and you've been covering him as the vice presidential nominee and now vice president-elect. What are some of your impressions of what kind of leader he is?
Well, as I mentioned before, Mr. Cheney is very conservative in his philosophy, but he's not particularly ideological in the sense that he's a crusader like a Tom DeLay or even a Dick Armey is. He's a very practical guy, a very no-nonsense type guy who looks for ways to get things done. This guy is kind of a manager first and a politician second, if you will. I think that's what kind of endears him to certainly Republicans. I mean, he has this sense, one Republican senator told me yesterday, you know, the grown-ups are in charge now, and specifically meaning a reference to Cheney. Mr. Cheney is 59 years old, and yet he's younger than almost half the Senate. Yet he has this aura of kind of a Washington wise man about him. He has been a White House chief of staff. He was a 10-year congressman from Wyoming. He was Secretary of Defense during the Persian Gulf War. He's very solid in kind of the way he comes across. He's also very conservative, which was masked a little bit, I think, by his tenure at the Defense Department, where you really don't focus on things like his votes on nutrition programs or whether to free Nelson Mandela, which he opposed. And so that it's yet to be seen kind of how his influence will play out kind of on domestic legislation. I think he'll play a tremendous role, though, throughout the entire administration. It's essentially almost a de facto chief of staff and a shadow Senate majority leader, if you will, and an uber national security advisor, somebody who oversees what's going on both at the Defense Department and in foreign policy. He clearly gets along very well with Colin Powell. These two guys worked together very closely during the first Bush administration during the Persian Gulf War. So I think in his quiet, kind of understated, but very powerful way, he will be a very, very important presence for this administration throughout Washington.
You've explained how Cheney is the, quote, adult. Who are the kids?
Well, I think in this case, there was the reference was more to the Clinton administration than it was to Governor Bush. But certainly over the last few weeks with Governor Bush kind of taking a much lower profile role, hanging out at his ranch and letting Dick Cheney be the public face of the administration, of the transition team, up until just the last few days, there's been this perception that perhaps Cheney is even eclipsing Bush. This is the go-to guy, you know, who's handling in a lot of the personnel matters. He's trying to set up the legislative agenda on the Hill. He's working away, even though he's back at work 3 days after suffering his fourth heart attack, and he just keeps churning along, and people are kind of amazed by all this. He doesn't tend to make mistakes or slip-ups, at least in public, that people can seize upon. He's also kind of a bland type of character, again, on the surface, so he's not necessarily prone to these kind of things. But I think when people say adult supervision, that's what they think. They get, just Republicans in particular tell me, they just get a very reassuring sense when they're around Cheney. This is a guy who's been there, he's done that, he knows what he's doing, and they feel like they feel very comfortable with him being there.
Eric Schmidt is congressional correspondent for the New York Times. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the bitter presidential election of 1800, which was tied in the Electoral College and could have ended in violence and destroyed the democracy, but it didn't. It ended with Thomas Jefferson emerging as president. We'll talk with Bernard Weisberger, author of a book about it, and we continue our talk with New York Times congressional correspondent Eric Schmidt. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our conversation with New York Times congressional correspondent Eric Schmidt. Schmidt has recently been writing about Vice President-elect Dick Cheney. Schmidt also covered Cheney when he served as Secretary of Defense in the administration of George W.'s father. When you were covering Cheney during the election aftermath, what would you do on the days when Cheney was just like behind closed doors?
That's the hard part about it, is because that's basically what he's been doing most of, is staying behind closed doors. He is not, again, one to give a lot of information about what he's doing. I recall one senior Pentagon official I talked to when I was doing a profile on Dick Cheney. This was like the number two or three guy at the Pentagon. And during the Gulf War, Cheney would go into these top-level briefings with President Bush and Secretary of State Baker and other top people. And after these big meetings at the White House, all the principals would go back and brief their deputies, all except for Cheney, who would just consider this to be such confidential information. He wouldn't even tell his top deputies, who had to go scurrying off to other parts of the government and get a fill from friends on what happened at this meeting, so they could help run the policy. This is kind of how Dick Cheney runs things, and it's the way the people around him run things as well. They're very professional, but they're very tight-lipped in terms of giving out a lot of information. So in terms of trying to cover what's going on in a story where they've been handicapped by being in this this weird kind of quasi-transition as they waited for the courts to rule, it's kind of been watching paint dry in some days.
The Congress, of course, is going to have to ratify any Supreme Court appointments if anybody leaves the Supreme Court, if any of the judges leave. They'll also have to ratify President-elect Bush's cabinet choices. Looking into the future a little bit, do you think that President-elect Bush is going to have a lot of trouble getting his choices ratified?
Well, I don't think his cabinet will have that many problems. He's talked about wanting to include at least one, maybe two Democrats, probably not in the most prominent cabinet positions, but still important ones. I think the judgeships and justices is another matter. These have been lightning rods over the last several years, certainly going back to the Bork nomination and Clarence Thomas nomination. And I think these are the ones, particularly after this whole bitter fight with the Supreme Court intervening, and to many Democrats appearing to hand the presidency to George W. Bush, if there are Supreme Court positions to fill, these are going to be very tricky for the new president to deal with and for the Congress to deal with as well. I think that's where you'll see the major fights. I don't think you'll probably see them on the cabinet positions as much. And I'm told that the governor will probably announce most of his cabinet by Christmas. Dick Cheney's been doing a lot of vetting, a lot of calling of people, and so I think we'll have a pretty good picture of who these people are. Most likely have Senate hearings, confirmation hearings on most, if not all, of these people before the inauguration on January 20th. So there's a real emphasis now in this truncated transition period to get these people in place as soon as possible after the new administration takes power.
President Clinton is serving his final days as president. He was impeached during his presidency and then continued in his presidency and continued to work with the Congress. As he leaves, I'm wondering how you would assess how he handled himself and how much he was able to get done after the impeachment.
Well, what was always so striking was the way the American public were able to separate Bill Clinton, the personality, and what they believed about his, you know, his personal problems in the whole Monica Lewinsky scandal, and Bill Clinton, the politician, who was universally, almost even among Republicans, held in awe as a master politician. This was a guy who was pretty much given up for dead politically after the impeachment. Nobody gave him any chance of getting much of anything done afterward. And yet, for instance, he was able to get a major China trade bill through, for instance, with a Congress that was, particularly in the House and among his own party, were very much opposed to this. In terms of as a politician, I think he was always respected, and even people like Dick Armey would just kind of shake their heads if they walk out with this guy, and particularly in these budget negotiations, just having their hat handed to them at the end of the day when it came to getting more money for some of the priorities he wanted in healthcare or education. He was very successful in doing this. Obviously, he has not been able to get some of his initiatives through this year, and including a minimum wage. But I think over the long haul, his political legacy as a politician will be quite good.
When you look ahead to the new Congress, which little plots are you most interested in following the development of?
Well, there are several. I've mentioned a few of them. The delicious subplot between George W. Bush and Tom DeLay, for instance. Which wing of the Republican Party is going to prevail here? Or are they actually the same wing, and it's just a matter of which face are you going to put on it? I think Governor Bush is perhaps more conservative than he lets on with his rhetoric, and maybe closer to Tom DeLay than he would ever want people to know. But just which Republicanism kind of prevails on Capitol Hill will be fascinating.
With the compassionate conservatism or the more hardline.
That's correct. Uh-huh. That's correct.
What else?
Watching Tom Daschle in his role. This is a guy who was, I think, greatly underestimated by a lot of his Senate colleagues when he came to be the minority leader of the Senate. He won in a very close election. And he's come to become regarded as one of the savviest politicians in Washington. Well, now he's holding some of the most powerful chips in town, and to see how he plays it, both with Democrats and Republicans, will be very interesting to watch. I think watching how the Gore Confederates in Washington, both in Congress and just around town, handle themselves. Will they follow their leader's advice last night to kind of join and try and unify the country, or will they spend at least next 2 years trying to sabotage and subvert the Bush administration, hoping to regain power for Democrats in the House and Senate, and ultimately for perhaps Al Gore, another Democrat, in 2004. The role that African Americans in Congress will play, in how they react to this election, the way the court ruled, and how energized African Americans become in the electoral process. There was an interesting story the other day about how 9 out of 10 African Americans voted against Governor Bush in this election, despite his best efforts to reach out, and certainly with the addition of General Powell and Condoleezza Rice as a probable national security advisor, both of whom are black. It'll be interesting to see if this mollifies the black community at all when it comes to the policy discussions on Capitol Hill.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, you're welcome.
Eric Schmidt is congressional correspondent for the New York Times. Coming up, the presidential election of 1800, which was tied in the Electoral College and nearly ended in the destruction of the democracy. This is Fresh Air. Last night, while discussing the need to find common ground and build consensus, President-elect Bush referred to another close presidential election 200 years ago, when two presidential candidates were tied in the Electoral College. That left the vote to the House of Representatives, which was also tied. It took 6 days and 36 ballots to break the tie, with Thomas Jefferson emerging as America's third president. My guest, Bernard Weisberger, is the author of a new book about that election called America Afire. The election of 1800 between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams was a bitter one that could have ended in violence and destroyed the democracy. Jefferson and Adams had been partners in the Revolution, but they had become enemies after they ran against each other for president in 1796. In that era, the runner-up in the presidential election became vice president. So in the 1796 election, Adams won the presidency, with runner-up Jefferson becoming vice president. In the next election, in 1800, Jefferson ran against Adams again. This was the first election with two competing political parties. Jefferson was a Republican, Adams a Federalist. I asked Weisberger to explain the party differences.
Well, in brutally condensed form, the Federalists were in favor of a government, a very stable government, run by a wealthy and educated elite with very little input from below. Their model, many of them were in the merchant trade, and their model was a ship. The officers were on the quarterdeck and ran the ship efficiently and for the benefit of everybody, but the crew didn't get to vote. Jefferson, on the other hand, was in favor of a more decentralized government, a weak government that left people pretty much to themselves, and also in favor of admitting large numbers of small property holders to the electorate.
Now, Adams had just signed the Sedition Act, which made criticizing the president a crime. And here he was running for re-election, so you couldn't criticize him when he was running for re-election because that would have been a crime?
You could indeed, and you could be put in jail for it. And one of the things that's important to note is that the First Amendment was only 9 years old. It had just been passed and ratified in 1791, and nobody paid much attention to it. And the people were actually tried and fined and in some cases given jail terms of up to a year and a half for statements critical of the president. And that was, of course, considered quite properly an outrage by the Republicans. And two Republican state legislatures actually passed resolutions, one set secretly drafted by Jefferson, that said that a state had a right when the federal government was violating its constitutional limits to nullify the act. It never quite came to that, but there was a genuine threat there of states refusing to operate under federal authority. So that contributed to the crisis atmosphere in 1800.
So does that mean that Adams' opponents during this election couldn't criticize him?
Well, they did. I mean, they couldn't prosecute. The fact is that the law was widely resisted. Even some of the Federalists had misgivings about it. There were a couple of dozen cases of arrests and trials, but the answer is yes, you could criticize him, and many did and got away with it, but some did not, and some men went to jail for it. Including a number of rather well-known journalists of the time, and the journalism of the time, by the way, was an extremely strident and scurrilous journalism, full of personal accusations and personal charges. I mean, mudslinging was not invented in the 20th century, so. It was, it created an atmosphere of enormous tension. And the whole country, remember, is very young. The Constitution is new. It's hardly tested. And there is a real danger of its flying apart.
And the election system was pretty different then compared to how it is now. Describe what some of the major differences were.
Sure. The major difference was that there were no formal conventions or nominating conventions. The party leaders or the party's candidates were named by congressional caucuses of the party's leaders. Both parties, interestingly, denied that they were parties. The people at the time were very worried about factionalism that could split countries apart. They were afraid that if people got too wrought up in defense of their own special interests instead of considering the overall interest of the country, that, as I say, that the country could be confronted with civil wars and commotions. So the Federalists simply said they were the party in power. They were the people who had been elected with George Washington, and they were simply running the government and in the interest of the nation. And those who criticized them and dissented from them were actually enemies of government. They were seditious. And the Jeffersonians, the Republicans, on the other hand, simply said that the Federalists were creating an aristocracy and were pushing the country back in the direction of monarchy, and they were Republicans with a small r because they believed in a republic, not a monarchy.
Now, something very surprising and confusing happened in this election. Adams and Jefferson were running for president, but because of the way the presidential and vice presidential votes were tallied then, Thomas Jefferson's vice presidential running mate, is that a fair word?
I think so.
Aaron Burr was actually tied with Jefferson for the presidential vote. Now, how did that happen, that Burr and Jefferson were tied when really Jefferson was running against Adams?
Once there was a tie, the election was to be decided in the House of Representatives, each state having one vote. And there were only two choices, Jefferson or Burr. Now, there was another provision of the Constitution, no longer existing, which said that the Congress elected in a given election didn't meet for another year. But the Congress that had been elected 2 years earlier would meet for one final session. So the Congress that was going to decide the fate of Jefferson and Burr was not the Republican Congress that had just been elected. It was a Congress dominated by the Federalists, by John Adams's party. And so their fate was now in the hands of their political opposition. And the Federalists concocted an idea, not formally, of blocking the election of either man by voting consistently for Burr. They controlled six states. Two were tied. That is, the state delegations were evenly split, Republican and Federalists. And Jefferson had only eight, but he needed nine to win, 9 of 16. So what the Federalists thought of doing was continuing to vote for Burr, preventing Jefferson from getting his majority, and doing that right up until Inauguration Day, which was then March 4th. And that on that day, they would then say, and they were still in control of Congress, look, there is no president. We have a real crisis here. Somebody has to fill the office, and we will pass special legislation and either retain John Adams or name a Federalist to the presidency. And that would have been a sort of constitutional coup. And the Republican response to that was that if you do that, you will probably break up the Union. One Republican governor of Pennsylvania said, we will just not recognize a usurpation. We will not obey any orders that come from Washington. And we will not, and if need be, we will arrest federal officials and jail them. Republicans in Virginia spoke of leaving the Union and calling for a new constitutional convention. So there's a real threat of a breakup there. And for one whole week, the country was in suspense while the House took ballot after ballot after ballot with the Federalists refusing to budge.
Now, why didn't Aaron Burr step down and say, you know, I withdraw? Why didn't he withdraw from the election, and then it would have had to go to Jefferson, and this constitutional crisis and the possibility of civil war would have been ended?
Absolutely. Why didn't he? It's the mystery of Aaron Burr, who was still, after 200 years, a controversial character. Charming, brilliant, and with no known political principles, and flirted with both parties. He could, of course, have simply unequivocally declared that he would not serve if elected, but he didn't. He kept his own counsel, kept the game in his own hands, leaving the Federalists to think that possibly if they picked up a couple of Republican votes, they could elect him and that he would do business with them. Jefferson always felt betrayed by Burr, and when Burr did become vice president in the event, just cut him out of party patronage altogether, left him a man without a party. Burr's defense simply was, I would not withdraw because it would be an insult. It would assume that I did not feel equal to the task of being president, and what is more, so long as I was available as a constitutional choice, which he was, I was sparing the country a true crisis.
My guest is Bernard Weisberger, author of America Afire, about the election of 1800. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's get back to our interview with Bernard Weisberger, author of America Afire, about the presidential election of 1800, which was tied in the Electoral College and then was tied in the House of Representatives. So how was the tie between Burr and Jefferson finally broken?
Well, it was broken in a way that was enormously beneficial to the country. In effect, the Federalists finally blinked. And what they did was to caucus and finally allow a couple of Federalist states to cast blank ballots. And Jefferson won with 10 states. That was about 2 weeks before Inauguration Day. Why? Partly, I think, because when push came to shove, I think they did not really want to disrupt the Union. And it is possible that, you know, informal understandings were reached. But one way or another, I think the Federalists felt that they could take a chance with Jefferson, and that it was better to take a chance with Jefferson than to continue on their course and face who knew what chaos. And you know, given the fact that it had been a very turbulent and violent 4 years preceding with that sedition law on the books and with a war scare with France and with some street fighting and a great deal of Billingsgate thrown around in the press, it was probably a wise decision.
Was the public as divided as the Republicans and the Federalists were?
That's interesting, because so it seemed the electorate was small at the time, and there weren't many vehicles for expressing public opinion except a handful of newspapers, which printed letters from people. Some people did tend to speak out very intensely. I mean, there were Federalists who said that Jefferson was an atheist and a destroyer of all sacred institutions because Jefferson had expressed sympathy for the French Revolution. There were Republicans who swore that the Federalists were going to restore the monarchy, and even circulated stories that John Adams was planning to marry a couple of his sons to the daughters of King George and establish a dynasty. But on the whole, they seemed to have represented extremes, because when Jefferson took office, and one would hope that this might be a model to whoever takes office on January 20th, he made an absolutely wonderful inaugural address in which he said, "Look, we are all," the words are his, "we're all Republicans, we're all Federalists," by which he meant that the Republicans didn't really want to pull apart the Union and the Federalists didn't really want to reinstall the monarchy. He said, we are one people, we have a wonderful future ahead of us, a great continent. We have gotten excited and shouted at each other, but every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. We have called brethren by different names. And that seemed to ring a bell, this appeal to this sense of American nationality, that with all the political fighting, there was really one American people. That sense of a growing American nationality, which had surfaced from time to time in the Constitutional Convention, was now re-invoked by Jefferson. And at the end of his first term, he was triumphantly reelected. So I think that on the whole, people got hot under the collar, but that they were not basically at each other's throats. They were not ready to break up the Union that they'd established in the Revolution only 25 years earlier.
When the Federalists decided to basically allow Jefferson to become president, mm-hmm. was this historically unusual for a group to hand over power, you know, democratically to their enemy, as opposed to keeping on resisting their enemy from coming into power?
Absolutely. It was the first time in a large modern state that had happened. So far as I know, it may be the first time in history that it happened, but I can't venture that far. In point of fact, that's exactly what they did do. Once the decision was made on February the 17th to, as you say, let Jefferson become president, on the morning of March 4th, John Adams quietly left Washington on a public conveyance by stagecoach, private citizen. He didn't stay around for the inaugural ceremony. And Jefferson, with a handful of civilian friends and associates, walked from his boarding house to the Capitol. Washington was a very new city then, and everything was within walking distance of everything else. And took the oath of office quietly and made unifying inaugural address I mentioned. And yes, that was indeed the first time this had happened in a country of any extent. And considering two things, considering the enormous extent of the country, which made people wonder if an experiment in republicanism could be carried on in the country so large and so diverse and with such poor communications, and considering that they were conducting this election against the background of the French Revolution, in which the heirs of the revolution had been murdering each other and drenching France in blood for 10 or 15 years, it was all the more remarkable. That's what makes the election, I think, probably the most special in our history.
Now, how did this election change the vice presidency? Was the method of choosing a vice president the same after this election was over?
No, they promptly changed that. Everybody knew they had dodged a bullet, and they passed the Congress sent to the states, which promptly ratified the 12th Amendment. And the 12th Amendment provides for a separate ballot for president and vice president. The problem with it was a few people objected because they said, look, nobody worth his salt really wants to be a vice president. It's not an office of any particular importance or glory. And what will happen is vice presidential candidates will be largely nonentities who are chosen because they have some sort of special following, some local or sectional following that'll vote for them. That is exactly what happened. So it did create the sort of the Alexander Throttlebottom vice presidency. That I think has changed in the last half of the century we've just finished. I mean, since World War II, vice presidents seem to be brought more and more into the loop, and a large number of them, as we see, become their party's next candidate. But it did condemn the vice presidency to a more than a century of insignificance.
Bernard Weisberger, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Bernard Weisberger is the author of America Afire. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Nonesuch Records, featuring Red Dirt Girl, the new album by Emmylou Harris, available in record stores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Ed Harris is starring as Jackson Pollock in a new movie about the artist's life. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Kirk Varnardo, who curated a major exhibit of Pollock's work for the Museum of Modern Art in New York. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.